Shaolin shadow boxing. And the Wu-Tang sword style. If what you say is true, the Shaolin and the Wu-Tang could be dangerous. Do you think your Wu-Tang sword can defeat me?
On guard. I'll let you try my Wu-Tang style.
Bring the motherfucking ruckus! Bring the motherfucking ruckus!
Hello, comrades, and welcome back to Season 3, Episode 7 of Spectre. I'm absolutely delighted today to be joined by a special guest, Keith Bennett from Friends of Socialist China. Keith, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, thanks. It's a great pleasure to be on, Nathan.
So perfect. Just if I can start then, Keith, just a wee introduction from yourself, you know, who you are, your affiliations and everything else in between.
Okay, so, I mean, I'm one of the two founders in Britain of Friends of Socialist China, and I guess we'll talk a bit more about Friends of Socialist China itself in a minute. But I've been interested in China for more than half a century. I got interested in China when I was 11 years old, which is a bit strange, particularly at the beginning of the very beginning of the 1970s. I didn't come from a political family at all. I didn't have family connections with Asia of any kind. But I got interested in politics and current affairs from very early on. And I think there was just something happening in China that captivated my imagination, even though in retrospect I understood very little about it at the time. But, you know, I got interested in China at the beginning of the 1970s. My parents, I think, were not terribly happy about it, but they said that it was just a phase that I was going through and I'd grow out of it. I'm sure they're right. I'm sure that will happen eventually, but it's, you know, it's 55 or so years later. It's not quite happened yet. So from pretty early on, in my secondary school life, I decided that I wanted to get to university and study Chinese history and politics, which I did at SOAS in London. They don't normally spell it out now, but School of Oriental and African Studies, or as we called it, School of Obscure and Antiquated Studies. So I took a degree in history and politics there. I started my university life in the week that the Gang of Four was arrested in China. So that was another kind of turning point. I was very lucky to be taught by two real experts in Chinese history and politics, one of whom had been a member of the Communist Party and had lived in China from 1945 to 55 in liberated areas, and then, of course, in the Infant People's Republic, joined the Communist Party on his return, and was an expert in peasant movements in China. So graduated in 1979 and went to work for an organization called the Society for Anglo-Chinese Understanding, or SACU, which still exists. Went to China for the first time in 1981, when the reform period was just getting underway, and I've been going back pretty regularly since, and most of my working life and political life have been bound up in one way or another with China.
No, that's great. Cheers for that, Keith. That's a good rundown. And yeah, like you said, I guess we'll just kind of roll straight on to Friends of Socialist China. I think that's a great point to kind of begin this episode. Yeah, Friends of Socialist China, if you're able to kind of give us a brief, you know, who you are as an organisation, what is it you do, and, you know, what's your kind of overall mission as well?
Right, so Friends of China is basically a pretty new organisation. It was just set up in May 2021. We had pretty much the ultimate soft launch, in that without any advance warning, a website appeared with one fairly brief news item on it. Funnily enough, I'd have to double check this, but funnily enough, I think it was about China's position on Palestine at the time. And there was some other details about who we are, what we wanted to do. We'd been talking about it, discussing it for several months before then, with myself, Carlos Martinez, here, and Danny Hyfong in New York, who's quite a well-known internet personality on geopolitics and so on. And obviously, as I said earlier, I've been interested in China really all my life. Carlos also had came from a family with a big interest in China, and had increasingly become more interested in China, had made his first visit to China the end of 2019, beginning of 2020. And we looked at I guess we looked at several things. One, that China was both, more and more putting forward policies, positions, points of view on the great interests of the day, of world politics, the future of socialism, how socialism can and could and should be built in the present world. And at the same time, also because of that, the international situation was getting more acute. China was coming under more attack and hostility with the new Cold War and so on. And also, in response to both of those two things, among progressive people, people on the left, anti-imperialists and others, there was a growing, without seeking to exaggerate it, but there was a certain growing interest in China, in what China was doing in its own country, what sort of positions it was putting forward in the world. And we saw a need to do something to promote that. We didn't have any master plan of how the thing would develop. It started simply as a website. But what happened as we went on was that people assumed there was an organization, actually more than there actually was one, and people wanted to identify with it. And so it sort of began to grow organically because of that. And so from fairly early on, the content of the website, which gradually built up more, and social media activity, that was then complemented with webinars. And webinars obviously were more important at that time. We were still in the COVID period, so there were either restrictions or reluctance to hold public meetings. Plus, I think we all found during that period that we could reach a lot more people around the world with a webinar than just booking a small room above a pub or something. But gradually, obviously the webinars then became complemented with some public activities and hybrid online offline meetings. We started to get invitations to China, and that built up to April of this year. We had a delegation of 14 people were specifically invited as the first dedicated Friends of Socialist China delegation. We had people mostly from Britain, but also from Ireland and the United States take part in that. And then building up, we had the biggest public activity we had so far, physical public activity, was the meeting in London on September the 28th, jointly with the Communist Party of Britain, where we filled the Bolivar Hall, the cultural center of the Venezuelan embassy in London, for a conference marking the 75th anniversary of the People's Republic of China. And we also had on that day a 12-page special supplement in the Morning Star, which was great. And we launched a book, PRC 75, an anthology, full title PRC 75, The Flag Stays Red. So we've been attracting, more support from people in different progressive organizations and movements. We've had, great working relationship with the Communist Party, with the Morning Star and so on, which has, I think, been certainly helped us, but I think it's been mutually beneficial. And we're looking towards what we can do in 2025.
Yeah, no, that's great, Keith, and it has been great to see the kind of growth of the organization Friends of Socialist China, because organizations like it play a vital role when we look to other socialist states like Cuba, for example, the role that various Cuba solidarity networks play in displacing a lot of the narrative, the false narrative that's put out there, and that imperialist hostility that's meant to drive so many, you know, unconscious, class conscious workers blindly against it for whatever development of foreign policy is then pushed through Parliament or pushed through Washington to enact further tariffs, further blockades against these states. And obviously we'll come on to talk about kind of that yellow peril and the new wave of the Cold War. But, you know, these groups, you know, play a vital role historically as well, looking at the various friendship groups that have existed for the sake of the Soviet Union. They played a vital role, not just, like it says, in putting out articles and whatnot or meetings, but the practicality of these organisations working in tandem with other supporting groups and getting people over there, especially. I think probably what highlights to me, mainly because I've already got so many books sitting in my bookshelf in the other room about it, but you know, trade union delegations as well, worker delegations, to see how day-to-day life actually is away from the Murdoch press, away from the BBC and the narratives that we see. So I think that's the real vital role that Friends of Socialist China plays now in that, because we are seeing a rise in hostility, not just with how NATO and America continues to move around the Chinese territory and airspace, but as well as the consequences of that at home. I think it was during the kind of time where the secret police station scandal was happening across Britain, and our communist societies here in Scotland saw a rise in, you know, anti-Asian discrimination and, you know, essentially hate crimes, with graffiti being sprayed up across uni campuses, essentially telling Chinese students, calling them all communists and telling them to go home. So with groups like Friends of Socialist China, they do play that, you know, I like to say a leading role and a strong role at kind of displacing this and bringing across solidarity, both connecting the people of China and, you know, wherever these groups exist all together to displace that. So, no, I think it's superb what you guys have done so far. And, you know, with it, like you said, it's only been about for about 3-4 years now, then, you know, it can only go to even greater heights, which I'm looking forward to witnessing. But I guess that brings us on to kind of covering China throughout the ages. When we talk about China and, I guess, attacks on China, it's not just from the right wing. We get very elements of the so-called left who continue to brutalise China, and they effectively become the lapdogs for imperialism, doing the job for them inside our own camp, trying to undermine the Chinese people, undermine the Communist Party of China over there, and distort the image. I can only imagine Rupert Murdoch sitting back and laughing as he watches these so-called socialist and left-wing organisations bash the People's Republic, utilising only his fabricated sources or relying entirely on Radio Free Asia for their news. It's laughable, but just to see if you can give us a kind of, you know, a brief history of the formation of socialist China, and maybe we can touch on kind of its footprint today.
Right. So, brief history of socialist China. That's no, where to start? I mean, I think the first point I'd like to make is that, you know, China is the country with the longest history of a continuous civilization, and you know, of approximately 4,000 years, and that very much continues to influence the way Chinese people think, how they approach and deal with problems. Some of the wording that comes into their you know, political discourse, you know, has a long history that, even though I've been interested in China all my life, I'm only just starting to get my head around something. And I just did an editing job about a book on the, I think the title is going to be The Emergence and Governance of Ancient China, and it's talking about things that happened in, you know, 1000 BCE and so on. And I come across phrases there, and it's like, Ah, so that's where it came from. And I think so. It's like there's a whole, it's even when some of the Chinese politics is translated into English, there's still a whole different language that people have to learn. And I think that's maybe a something a bit of a barrier where you mentioned Cuba a little bit earlier. I think for people in the West, like socialism in Cuba is a lot easier to understand. And so on. It feels culturally closer. So, as I said, China has this long civilizational history, and for about 17 of the last 20 centuries, China, followed by India, was the world's leading economy. But capitalism and imperialism developed in the West, and China entered into a period of feudal stagnation and decline. Obviously, all the imperialist powers fell upon China, starting with Britain with the First Opium War of 1839, where essentially Britain went to war because a Chinese government official decided that it wasn't a good idea for the British East India Company to. To be allowed to flood the country with opium and reduce the Chinese people to addiction. So Britain went to war with China to enforce that particular aspect of free trade, and that inaugurated an era where all the imperial and colonial powers fell on China to a greater or lesser extent. That's when China was forced to cede Hong Kong to Britain as part of the what the Chinese call, quite rightly, the unequal treaties that were inaugurated by the Treaty of Nanking, which ended the First Opium War. So you had a country that had this great civilizational history, but was reduced to a plaything of foreign powers. People were cast into misery, and. So you had, and that's the period that the Chinese call the century of humiliation, because China became a plaything and an object of bullying by the Western powers as well, of course, as Japan and Tsarist Russia prior to the 1917 revolution, and so people, obviously, Chinese people, enlightened people, were looking for a way out of this situation in which they found themselves, where their country, of which they were also so proud, had been reduced to such a state of misery and poverty and oppression by foreign powers. So people looked at, all sorts of things. They thought about just learning from the West and emulating the West, and if they would become a good pupil of the West would treat them nicely. Mao once referred to that in I think it's in his article on the People's Democratic Dictatorship, written in 1949, where he says that people couldn't understand why the teacher was always beating the pupil about the fate of those Chinese who were looking to the West. And then Dr. Sun Yat-sen, who was a great nationalist revolutionary, led the revolution of 1911, which founded the Republic of China. But that failed to consolidate itself. It entered into a period of warlordism and so on. And things really began to ch the real turning point in Chinese history, really, you can say, was the October Revolution in Russia in 1917, and the things that were going on around that. The October Revolution wouldn't have happened at the time and the way it did without what the First World War had done to Russia. And then in 1918, the victorious powers met at Versailles to decide the post-war situation. And at that time, Germany had certain concessions in China, basically provinces, the province of Shandong, which was under their control, and China had entered the war as on the Allied side, on the victorious side and naturally assumed that the German concessions in China would be handed back to China. Instead, they were given to Japan, and that provoked a wave of a movement known as the May 4th movement. After the Chinese government representatives capitulated and signed the Treaty of Versailles, there was a huge movement spurred by youth and students, which is known as the May 4th movement in China. It started in Beijing University, and it was led by small group of intellectuals who were the first people in China who'd begun to study Marxism. And out of that, the out of that, and with the support of the Communist International, the Communist Party of China was formed in July 1921, with I think 21, 22, or 21 or 22 delegates at the founding Congress representing 56 party members drawn from various communist groups that had sprung up around the country. So the Communist Party of China began with 56 members, which, when you think that it now has very nearly 100 million members, shows a very interesting trajectory over the next ensuing century and a bit. So the Chinese Communist Party was founded in 1921, but the understanding of Marxism in China was still pretty shallow. Not many Marxist texts had been translated into Chinese at that point, although they were starting to be some of the key ones, like the Communist Manifesto. Marxism, as originally established by Marx and Engels, had comparatively little, not nothing, but comparatively little to say about a society like China. Marx and Engels lived basically most of their adult life in Britain. They were looking at how they were looking much of the time at how, well, A, at the analysis of capitalist society itself, and B, how the most advanced capitalist societies of that time could transition to socialism. So you had a country like China, which had a very small working class in the Marxist sense, but a vast peasantry. So there were all sorts of debates among the Chinese communists, and also, in the Communist International, principally between those forces who lined up around Stalin and those who lined up around Trotsky during the 1920s. What role the national bourgeoisie would play in the struggle, what stages, if any, would there be in the Chinese Revolution, and so on. But the most fundamental breakthrough, I think, came that Mao, initially against the skepticism of a lot of his comrades, pointed out that that the vast majority of China's population at that time were the peasantry, and that they were oppressed and exploited, and that it was actually possible to make a revolution in a country like China with a Marxist-Leninist party, where the working class leadership was provided essentially by the proletarian ideology of the party, but with the peasantry as the main force, and that this could be done by basing the revolutionary forces in the countryside, where they would have a greater degree of support, where they had relatively greater freedom to operate, at least in certain places, compared to the situation of absolute white terror that had been imposed in the cities, and that they could gradually build revolutionary base areas and surround the cities from the countryside, and then ultimately seize nationwide political power, which, in very broad brushstroke terms, it is what went on to happen. So Mao started to formulate this policy, but it also became a matter of necessity, because the Kuomintang, which was the national bourgeois nationalist party, but anti-imperialist party, founded by Sun Yat-sen. Sun Yat-sen died prematurely. The leadership of the Kuomintang passed to Chiang Kai-shek, who had a much more right-wing position. And in 1927, Chiang Kai-shek unleashed a terrible massacre in Shanghai, which was the main center of the Chinese working class and what was then a rapidly growing Communist Party, launched a wave of white terror, which almost wiped out the Communist Party. So it retreated to the countryside, to a fairly remote area called the Qinkangshan Mountains. And they did so, as a defeated force, as the only way to survive. But I think it was Mao's genius to see that they could actually turn the situation on its head, and actually use this as the springboard for the revolution. I've probably only answered about half your questions. So if you want to come back and remind me of the rest of it, I'll have another go.
No, that's great. I mean, covering a brief history, that's I'd have to dedicate hours to kind of cover the progression to socialist China, but that I think that does serve as a good kind of brief into the early years. And obviously, I think from an outsider's perspective, looking in, it as a wide and almost crazy history, considering how many. Well, like almost all socialist states that have strived to form, it's been unrelenting pressure, and unrelenting fighting that's been continuous, both internally for civil conflict and as well as fighting off imperialist forces who are determined just to crush the revolution at its earliest stages. Obviously, Churchill referenced to the Soviet Union at the time. He wanted to kill the Bolshevik baby in its cradle, and that's been a continuous theme we've seen, throughout, even against China. But I guess it kind of brings us on to, I guess, China today. Its kind of structure of socialist life in the People's Republic, day-to-day life, and the democracy that we actually see compared to the so-called democracy we know here in the West, because obviously running the Communist Party stall in Buchanan Street, we do attract as a big thanks to our massive gazebo that we've got with a giant iron sickle on it. It does draw some eyes, but we do get a wide range of people who've traveled the world, and you get some surprising people who are, they're not communists, they barely follow politics, and if they've been to China for work, they praise it to the highest standard of what it is, no matter whereabouts in China they've been, about how it's continuing to grow and how it's changed so much in even just a year from when they've last been. So it was just to see, Keith, if you can kind of give us a wee rundown kind of what China is today and its functions, because I think it does play this vital role, especially now in the wider political frame of this new multipolar world as well.
Great questions you ask, but they're so wide ranging. I scarcely know where to begin. I think, as I mentioned a bit earlier, I first went to China in 1981, and I was tremendously impressed by what I saw, because obviously the beginning of the 1980s it was a different world. China was still very much a poor country then, but we also well I you know I also had some knowledge of what the situation was like in most of the rest of what we now call the global south, the famines and the destitution throughout much of South Asia, Africa, Latin America, the shanty towns, and the homelessness and so on. And in China you saw none of that. And I spent a month in China at that time, and went to quite a few different places, including a couple of communes, as they still then were, in a east central province called Anhui, where we were the first foreigners who had ever visited this place. And every morning when we kind of turned out to go from our lodgings to the dining hall for breakfast, the entire village assembled just to look. Absolutely, of course, no hostility, but just incredible curiosity, as though you may have landed from Mars. I think what was important then that impressed me, that yes, people were poor, and probably at that time I didn't realize to the extent that I would now just how poor they were. But people had dignity, and they had the essentials of life. People were clothed and fed and housed and educated and had medical care, and then their children went to school and they had work, and so on. So that was something that greatly impressed me. And I now think back to a time, it must have been about 10 or 15 years ago, and I'd actually I took a friend to China, and she hadn't been there for before. So I took her to some of the tourist sites, and we were in Tiananmen Square, and a young woman came up to me and said, "Excuse me," and said in pretty perfect English, "Excuse me, but would you mind having a photo taken with my father?" And I said, "Sure, why not?" And she said, "My dad has just come up to Beijing to spend the weekend with me, and he's never seen a foreigner before. Would you mind having a photo?" And so they had in one generation, literally from somebody in a rural area had never seen a foreigner, and there's his daughter living and working in one of the great cities of the world, speaking flawless English. And they're in just one tiny, tiny microcosm of a father and daughter. You can see some of what you alluded to in your remarks just now, that huge progress that China has made. When I first entered China, we went on a train journey from Hong Kong, which was still a British colony at that time, where I did see, that's the one part of China where I did see people begging and homeless and sleeping on the streets and so on. We went by train from Hong Kong to Canton, and I think, just for hours and hours, you just saw rice fields, maybe the odd cottage or hut every so often. And I did that same train journey a few years ago, and I don't think I saw a single blade of grass. It was either factories or universities or residential areas, completely transformed. And one of the things I've noticed as I've traveled in China is, of course, the Beijing and Shanghai are huge, bustling, modern cities, but up to a point, almost any country can have a bit something of a showpiece capital city. But you go to quite remote areas of China, and to what they will call third or fourth tier cities, and you see the same modernization development, and you see it right throughout the rural areas. Last year, I was on a delegation, in China with representatives from quite a few European communist parties, including from Britain and Ireland. And we went to Guizhou, which is in southwest China. And Chinese said, "Well, we're going to this because this is one of our poorest provinces." But again, the level of development there, particularly in some of the new villages and small towns, was phenomenal. So, people were saying, "Well, if this is the poorest, this is something quite incredible." And I think this is, I think if you look back to my earlier interest in China, it was an example of what an extremely poor country, a country from extremely poor beginnings, could do. So your points of reference were Sub-Saharan Africa, India, and so on. And one of the things that we lost with the collapse of the Soviet Union was that we could point to, in those days, we could point to societies in Europe where, okay, they didn't have the consumer society that we had, but for a lot of working class and poor people, if they were able to see the reality of what life was like in the Soviet Union or Czechoslovakia or the German Democratic Republic, they could see that that was, actually not at all a bad place to live, for working people. And I think China is now, I mean, China's now a middle income country. It will become a high income country in the next maybe 10, 15 years. But it's still not widely known in this in a country like Britain. But actually, increasingly, China is approaching the stage where actually, if working class people knew the truth about China, they would say that actually the quality of life and the conditions of life for the majority of people in China are starting to stack up very favorably compared to an increasing number of people in our own countries. And that's also reflected in the fact that for it was, after the Cultural Revolution, after the death of Mao, when Deng Xiaoping came to power, and there was a concerted move to improve relations with the West, and that's when Chinese students started to come overseas to study. And at that time, there was some debate in China as to whether they would allow this. And some people said, because China was a poor country at the time, some people said, well, if we allow our students to go overseas, many of them won't come back. And Deng Xiaoping said, well, it doesn't matter if they come back, or if a lot of them don't come back anyway, the net result for the country will still be favorable, which I think he was proved right about that. But if you look now, the number of students who come to the West, to Britain and other countries, who then want to stay as opposed to go home, is getting less and less. And you're also seeing many leading Chinese professionals, scientists, who've lived in the West for decades, who are deciding that now's the time to go home because they're facing racism and suspicion on the of for being Chinese, but also higher education in the West is underfunded. They don't have the money for their research activities, whereas in China that's not a problem. And generally they can have a better quality of life, better professional circumstances for their work, and so on. I think, of course, take up another issue. We've been told in the West that China is a police state. Actually, you see very, very few police in China. Where you do, for example, at the scene of a traffic accident or something, the police in China are unarmed. And when you do see police in China, one of the things you often see is people actually arguing very assertively their point of view with the police, and the poor guy just has to stand there and take it as they're, berated in no uncertain terms as each side puts their point of view, and he's trying to kind of, appease these two groups of people who are having some kind of dispute about whose fault it was that they ran into their bicycle or whatever. And, people in China simply are not afraid of the police. They will argue, and they will argue and assert their point of view in a way that would definitely get you arrested in Britain. And I've seen that time and time again, and so have many other people. And I think that there's also, of course, Chinese democracy is a work in progress. It takes time for people to actually reach the cultural and intellectual level where they can play a full part in the running of the state and society. So it is a work in progress. I don't want to suggest by any means that it's perfect. But it works in a very different way from what we know as democracy in Britain. Xi Jinping calls it whole process people's democracy. So that, for example, when you get up to the highest parliamentary level in China, which is the National People's Congress, which meets like for once a year, but for about 2 weeks. So that's always called in the West, sort of derisively referred to as a rubber stamp parliament, because because its decisions are all supposedly unanimous. Actually, they're not all unanimous, although some of them are, and some of them, most of them, if there are negative votes or abstentions, that they're a small number. But it would be an exaggeration to say that they're all unanimous. But it's not framed in a confrontational point of view, because it's based on a search for it's based on a search for consensus, because it's based on the idea that the fundamental interests of the overwhelming majority of the people are at the end, are at least compatible. They're not identical. People, I mean, Xi Jinping has said that society becomes more complex. There are different interest groups. People have different interests, but those different interests shouldn't necessarily be seen as antagonistic to one another, or irreconcilable. But also, the National People's Congress is a culmination of a process, because you have those congresses going right down to the most basic levels of villages or residential communities or an educational institution or whatever. And each one of those is elected, makes its policies and decisions for its own local areas, and then elects people to the higher bodies, and up it goes through cities or counties, provinces, up to the national level. So to the extent that there is a rubber stamp at the end of the process, it's because it's gone through any number of levels before it reaches that point. So that, for example, at the beginning of the National People's Congress, the Prime Minister, will deliver a work report. That first draft of that work report will have been circulated to all levels of the People's Congress system several months before. It's not like the theatrical secrecy of a only leaked to the bourgeois media, of course, of a UK budget. So that report will have been circulated at ver to various different levels. There will have been comments will have been invited. There will have been meetings of experts, economists, scientists, whatever's appropriate, called in to have roundtable meetings, discussions on relevant parts of the draft. There will have been thousands of amendments to it. And then it's delivered, and then it's deliberated on, and then at the end of it, there's the final version published, which will then contain just a few changes from the version that had gone out a couple of weeks previously. But that supposed first draft has already gone through, months of deliberations, and the General Secretary's report to the Party Congress operates on the same principle. And I think the other important thing to say is, yes, the National People's Congress meets just for 2 weeks a year, or occasionally, if there is need for a special session, that will be called. But the rest of the time, the deputies are in their local areas dealing with the issues of the people themselves, and also returning to their work. Being a deputy to the National People's Congress, which is equivalent to an MP in Britain, is, except obviously, at the highest level of the state, where you need people full time. But being a parliamentarian, for want of a better term, in China, is by and large not a full-time occupation or a profession. It's what people are from every walk of life, including ordinary workers and farmers, intellectuals, civil servants, and others, are elected at various stages by their peers to take on that function, in addition to their normal work and their normal role in society.
Yeah, no, that's a great brief there, Keith, and I guess just on the end point you made there about kind of that participation in democracy, actually having that voice and it coming at the very local levels is It's something we just don't see here. I mean, it's hard enough to get a MP, an MSP, or even your local councillor to attend a community council meeting, never mind trying to get them to properly come to a meeting about putting motions forward for the actual betterment of the community. Funnily enough, I was at the Kilpatrick hustings last night, where we've got a Communist Party candidate there as well, and even the constituents themselves are saying that they're not involved in any decision that happens in their community, whether it's the moving of public resources, the closure of them. They don't know when developments are happening, dodgy deals are being made, which they're none the wiser to, and it just kind of, I guess, it kind of captures that beautiful essence of capitalism, the backhand deal, and ordinary working people who rely on these things left in the dark. But you can see the actual beginnings and the fruitfulness of an actual kind of socialist system in China of democracy. Like you said, it's still got a lot to develop, and unsurprisingly, it's a country of 1.4 billion people. So of course it's still going to have to develop, but from what it is now, it's already miles ahead to what we have here in the West, and what's framed to us as democracy. And you touched on there, kind of your train journey from Hong Kong. It's seen that the capitalist element before going into socialist China, and I've touched on there the 1.4 billion people, the population in China. Imagine that under a kind of law of uneven development within capitalism, we would see hundreds of millions of people described as you did there in capitalist Hong Kong. So it's quite right that the socialist modernization has allowed for access to employment, food, education, the closing people's back, the real basics that are just to some people across the West, and different parts of the global South as well. They cost a fortune. Some would be considered luxury items, stuff that we take for granted, I guess, as a growing kind of decadence in the West. We've enjoyed the fruitfulness of imperialism and colonialism for so long that we overlook these basic necessities and pass them off. So I think the kind of system we see in China, with it constantly developing, it's a socialist state, operates around a Marxist-Leninist principle. It's a continuous growing and developing science, and it's part of this, I guess, ignorance, or maybe even some, not so much in ignorance, but maliciousness by either those on the so-called left and the right to attack it at every single angle, hoping that it breaks. But we know that quite rightly, that China's solidified itself, not just in terms of deterring physical threat, but as well as ideological. It does work hard, and I think, as I've touched on earlier, that's why Friends of Socialist China is so important in combating that narrative against it, when, as you said, you've seen firsthand, what it is, even in just the span of a month, what makes up China, how it develops, and everything else in between. So I think it's absolutely vital that the modern China that we see now under the principle of socialism, how it continues to develop, and it has been interesting to see, like you say, these third tier, fourth tier kind of cities continue to develop, or from their foundations of being at their early stages small tiny villages to like you see with the development of Zhejiang. I think that's a really great. So I think it's one that always ends up coming up in, I guess, my pages on Twitter and everything, especially foreign tourists going over there, and students, and just kind of seeing how life is day to day for people. And I guess with that kind of talking on the ideological kind of side of things, and with obviously China being a socialist state, it's under constant ideological threat, and not so much threat, I guess, malicious attacks. We're seeing this new wave of yellow peril, this continuous ramp up in anti-communist propaganda, tiring stuff that we've seen year in, year out. But we know that the Western and imperialist forces, they work tirelessly to pursue these arguments and these falsifications of fact. It's continuous, whether it be historically the Black Book of Communism, or now we're seeing with the propping up of CIA funded and founded so-called voices groups like Radio Free Asia to push out propaganda. It was just to see if you can give us a kind of insight from Friends of Socialist China how you guys work to displace these anti-socialist myths, anti-communist myths. The main one I think is in the headlines, which I'm more hopeful that newer generations coming in are kind of seeing it for what it is, just as a hoax, and the Uyghur genocide, which continues to be dismissed and disproven time and time again, both from the actual Muslim population living within China, as well as different diasporas outside as well. So it's just to see if you can give us a wee rundown on kind of your work as well in that, Keith, in combating this new wave of anti-Asian hate and anti-communist propaganda.
First of all, like anti-Chinese racism or Sinophobia, as it's now sometimes called, has a long history, as indeed though other kinds of racism in an imperialist society like Britain. But you go back to the 19th century, the tropes that were presented about Chinese people. Much the same as were, of course, as were presented about black people, Irish people, and so on. That the Chinese were dirty and lazy and indolent, and of course they were opium addicted. Well, to the extent that the last one was true, we know who was responsible for that. But like blaming the victim is not exactly, unusual in capitalist or imperialist discourse. But that so China was looked down on as the sick man of Asia. But the Chinese were presented as in a kind of quite contradictory way, as quite pathetic and helpless, but also as deeply sinister and threatening. The Fu Manchu thing and so on. So I think there was a reason for that, in that that I think people the people responsible for creating and spreading these things had some awareness within their own understanding and their own class standpoint of the threat that China could present to them, as they would say it, if the Chinese people were able to stand up, as Mao famously said that they did in 9, October 1949. So you have this undercurrent of Chinese anti-Chinese racism, which I think went again during that early period of the People's Republic, when China was perceived as being hostile to the West, which of course is another way of saying that the West was hostile to China. But the in that period when China was is seen as being a closed society and was convulsed by political turmoil, the Cultural Revolution, and so on, those kind of images of a threatening China, and of Chinese people as supposedly being fanatics or whatever, was heavily promoted. I think we saw less of that when the period of reform and opening up began, and China was considered to some extent a good partner of the West, and not a troublemaker, and so on. But I think the what happened with the reform and opening up in China was not what the West had expected and hoped to see, and had in fact, of course, been working for all along. Because I think the sort of Western imperialist powers had two basic expectations of what would happen in China. One is that although of course it would develop to a certain extent to meet the needs of Western markets, that China would go on being a place where you would assemble transistor radios, and they would make plastic toys and plastic flowers, and earn a pittance, and so on, and that Having tasted the great delights of making plastic flowers and plastic toys and so on, the Chinese would conclude that socialism was actually a pretty rotten system, and it would become a quote unquote liberal democracy like the West, and become a normal capitalist power occupying a duly subordinate part in the capitalist world division of labor. Now, the reality, of course, is that none of that happened. First of all, that China developed to an extent way beyond what they ever anticipated, to the extent that it is the world's second largest economy. It's on course to become the world's largest economy. It's increasingly leading the world in areas like quantum physics, supercomputing, and so on. It's becoming not, it's not, it's moving from a place, well, it's moved from a place primarily based on cheap low-end manufacture, assembly, or whatever, in that it leads in R&D and innovation, that the majority of peer-reviewed papers in scientific journals in the world are written by scientists from the People's Republic. And of course, the West, in contrast, hasn't exactly done terribly well over the last couple of decades. So in that regard, the Western expectations and plans were completely dashed. And in the other way that they've been completely dashed is that not only has China risen in a way that they never expected, but in doing so, far from rejecting Marxism-Leninism, far from getting rid of the Communist Party or turning it into some harmless nationalist or social democratic party, and embracing, fully embracing the private sector and getting rid of a state-directed economy, and so on, China has actually, I would say, particularly in the, 12 or so years since Xi Jinping became the general secretary, but also to some extent before this was already happening, but particularly in what the Chinese call the new era since Xi Jinping was elected general secretary of the 18th Party Congress, China has become more socialist. It's placed more emphasis on Marxism. It's reinforced ideological and political education. It's taken a more assertive place in the world, not simply, as Deng Xiaoping said in the early period of China's modernization, biding our time and not taking the lead and keeping a low profile. China is the one country that is putting forward credible, serious, realistic policies on all the great issues of the day, be it the conflict in the Middle East or the Ukraine, on climate change, and so on. So, the West's, the imperialist world's expectations and hopes and plans for China, I would say, have been pretty comprehensively trashed. And I think that feeding into all the other crises that the West is facing, culturally and economically and politically, with the rise of fifth-rate politicians pretty much throughout the imperialist world, really as a symbol of the sort of decline and of their system, I think that the collapse of their plans for China represents something of an existential shock for them. And I think this is why they've responded to this in a quite, in a quite irrational way, which is doing them no favors whatsoever. It's extraordinary to think that I think it was 2015 that Xi Jinping made a state visit to Britain, and it was, Cameron and Osborne said this was the golden era, and so on. And in the space of a couple of years, the what was actually the mainstream policy of a Tory government is now regarded as practically more or less, well, treasonous and subversive, you might say. But the same people are in power in China, the same party is in power in China, the same, it's following essentially the same policies. You can say China has continued to progress and has continued to deepen its course, but one thing is there's been no fundamental change in China in the last 10 years. The change has come on the part of the Western powers, and I think, we have to therefore lo locate the reasons for that. And I think that there's an element of desperation in the I think there's because I think a lot of the propaganda against China has reached quite hysterical levels. This also represents a feeling of desperation that they've almost lost it, and it's a kind of they have to kind of like throw everything at it in order hopefully regain their positions. But I think this is not working. I mean, it undoubtedly causes some minor troubles for China along the way, but basically, I think it's not working, and I don't think it's working on a number of levels. One, it's not stopped China's advance. It will through the sanctions that were taken, for example, against the telecom company Huawei, or the so-called chip wars, the attempt to prevent export of semiconductor chips to China. I mean, this may slow down some aspects of China's development for 2 to 3 years, but what it will do in the long term is only force China to become more self-reliant on these things and make greater progress. Huawei introduced a new phone a few months ago, which just amazed the world because it was so technically advanced. Whereas The Economist, this week's edition of The Economist has got an article explaining why Britain's mobile phone reception is the worst in the developed world, and one of the reasons cited by The Economist is because we're having to spend most of our time ripping out the infrastructure that Huawei had already kindly installed for us. And that's kind of not Friends of Socialist China propaganda, that's The Economist. And if you look back to the 1960s, China was a very poor country. It was completely blockaded by the United States, and blockaded and embargoed. Its relations with the Soviet Union had also collapsed, and it was convulsed by political turmoil. But even in that period, China succeeded in what they called the two bombs and one satellite in developing first atomic bomb and then hydrogen bomb, and then launching a space satellite in 1969 or 1970. So if China could do that under such invidious conditions, then there's really no limit to what they can do now. Yes, there's some problems with the economy post-COVID, but again, the Economist had a special supplement a few weeks ago on why the American economy is doing so well, and it's the envy of the world. And then they complement this with articles about how badly the Chinese economy is doing, but the Chinese economy is still growing at roughly twice the growth rate of the US economy. So it's not working on that level. It's not working on in the attempts to isolate China in the world as a whole. The developing countries, the countries of the global south, are more and more rallied around China. We've seen that, for example, in two big events this year. At the beginning of September, we had the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation, where the leaders of 51 or 52 African countries all came to China, and the whole number of agreements were reached. And of course, China's leading role in the BRICS, which had their summit then in October in Kazan in Russia, where you have, now nine full members, 36 countries in all represented, so several dozen countries with an interest in joining the BRICS in the future. Again, by far bypassing the G7 in population and in GDP size of their economies, and so on. And despite the attempts to isolate China, not only the countries of the global south, but if you look, most of the leaders of West European countries have visited China during this year, and now even Starmer wants to try and catch up, although in a pretty ham-fisted sort of way, which is what you would expect from him. And I think fine, and I r don't think it's really working on public opinion in Britain. I could be wrong, but I don't think it's working on public. I think a lot of people maybe absorb a bit of it, but most people actually are not very interested in China. I'd like to rectify that, but I think that's the reality. But for all that you see in the media here, and from some, quite a few politicians, the idea of I don't pick up any kind of vibe among people in Britain on any mass scale that they really think of China as a threat or an enemy. I don't think the propaganda is really resonating with them. And of course, the flip side to that is, as you said, that those people who go to China invariably, okay, if you take several thousand people visit a country, somebody's going to have what they think is a bad experience. But in general terms, when people go to China, they come back pretty, on the whole, they come back pretty happy and pleased with what they've seen. So the more people that can go, the better. And I think the point you raised about Xinjiang is a very important one. There's a country like Kazakhstan ne next to Xinjiang. There's also a Kazakh community in Xinjiang. If there was any kind of mass repression going on in Xinjiang, there would be refugees crossing borders and so on. We also live in a world where everything can be seen on, drones and satellite surveillance and so on. Is there even one credible horror story picture that they've been able to even fake from Xinjiang? There's not, I think one photo of a group of prisoners sitting cross-legged is the best you've had. But is there a genocide where the population in question actually grows at a rate higher than the rest of the country? And I think what really has brought this, certainly on the global stage, but I think it will also be increasingly in this country as well, is we have a real genocide going on before our very eyes. And it's the first genocide in history. It's an unenviable distinction, but it's the first genocide in history which everyone can watch live on their phones. There's no doubt, to my mind, or to I think to any reasonable person's mind, what's happening in Gaza, which our politicians are continuing to abet, to encourage, to persecute those who speak out against it. And these very same people are very indignant about an entirely non-existent genocide. And I think a lot of people are seeing this, including in the Muslim community. We actually had a meeting about Xinjiang last night at Marx Memorial Library, and also online, because there's with the three comrades who've all been in Xinjiang in the last few months. And we actually had, in the end, we got a decent turnout. We actually had quite a struggle to mobilize for that meeting, more than we were expecting. And we tried to sum that up. And I think one of the reasons is that with what's happening in Gaza in particular, people are actually starting to see Xinjiang as a non-issue. They weren't actually people weren't not coming because they thought, oh, we're not going to go and listen to this terrible thing. It's sort of like, yeah, well, we know that's a lot of whatever you want to call it. But we had, one of the comrades that spoke there is an Iraqi comrade, and he was saying that the care that's taken and the facility and the amount. He said he went to one mosque and he was talking with the imam, and he said I could speak to him in Arabic because most of the imams were also fluent in Arabic. So he says, how much did it cost to have the mosque renovated? And he said to very, oh, it was the government gave us $150 million to, renovate our mosque. And he was talking about the kind of books that they had in the Islamic libraries in the mosques in Xinjiang were the kind that he knew about from childhood, but that you can't find in Iraq anymore because of all the turmoil and conflict, and of course the occupation that Iraq has been subject to. So, our role in Friends of China, I think, is just to spread the truth as much as we can, and to show the achievements of China, to show what motivates them, what they're trying to do, what is the thinking that lies behind it. In, I would say, some might disagree, but I would say in quite a factual way. And yeah, as I said earlier, I think we can be quite pleased with what we've done over the last 3 years, but I wouldn't exaggerate it for one moment. What we're doing is really a tiny amount with minimal resources, which is complete, which is completely, well, there's just so much more that we should and could be doing. And that the what we're doing is really a drop in the ocean. But nevertheless, I think we've had a certain degree of impact.
Yeah, no, that's great, Keith. A lot to unpack for there, but certainly echo what you're saying about, I guess, the kind of West and the capitalist forces merging together to throw the kitchen sink at China, and that, last ditch effort. It becomes clearer and clearer, like you say, with each passing day, with these arguments falling apart from first-hand accounts, second-hand accounts, and although this the kind of modern digital era where there seems to be a constant rise in fabrications, there is, I guess, some glimmer where a lot of previously used imagery to try advocate and try validate a so-called Uyghur genocide gets disproven now, because there's actually resources that link to these images, one being the it springs to mind, and it's actually a training exercise in a prison where the guards have rifles, but there's no magazine, it's empty, and everybody's standing behind you. You can see folk actually like writing stuff down because they're learning what to do, and that was used as a prominent image of Chinese crackdown and putting people in prisons. But it's good to see that we can now utilize the kind of resources that we do have in social media to amply disprove it there and then. So we do get these tags on these images that are just recycled time and time again whenever the heat is dialed up against this one China. And not even that, and the kind of international side of things, looking back to here to like Scotland and Britain, like I mentioned there, that wave of secret Chinese police stations underneath Chinese restaurants, washing machines, everything. That was dialed to 11. We saw Green MSP here, Ross Greer, who's remained a cheerleader for the Taiwanese separatist movement, as well as just any anti-Chinese and anti-communist organization against China. He's been a staunch cheerleader for them for intervention in the region, heightening up a new Cold War. And he was at the forefront of these escalations. Yet to see him apologize to the owners of the restaurant and to the wider Chinese community for the hate and hysteria that he stirred up, alongside his strange bedfellow Stuart MacDonald, who actually sits on the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China, who aimed to reform policy in China to make it more aggressive, more difficult, and more hostile to the region. So you've got to laugh when these are the so-called progressives in the West who put themselves in this golden pedestal of bourgeois morality and just hype up to, like I says, 11 when it comes to any of these, factually incorrect statements and scares that are pushed time and time again. And they get in bed with the same profiteers who would make literally a killing off of intervention within the region, the South China Sea, wherever. And then like I says, they work tirelessly in their propaganda efforts as well as their parliamentary efforts to make it harder for like you said, progression to occur in the manner that the Communist Party and the people of China would like to see it. You know, there's stuff that could happen in the year, but due to sanctions, tariffs, and everything else in between, it often takes that wee step longer. But the next point I had on just the agenda here, but I feel that we've quite covered it well, because we're tying in this ideological aspect, there is the actual mobilized forces of imperialism, the US Army, NATO, and everything else in between. But I feel that we have covered that because the like of the AUKUS pact that's continued to grow with Australia, Britain, America, and whatnot. So further aggression in the South Chinese Sea, trying to hide behind the guise of the Philippines as well, as well as the wider proxy war involving the Russian-Ukraine conflict. You know, so much money being piled on onto that to say that, you know, we need to ramp up against Russia because China's helping them as well. But the reality is, it's the combined forces of Europe that are marching eastwards against China, against Russia, and then just a resolute determination to eliminate socialism, because for them it's fearful for them, China growing and developing to you know, put them in a position that sees them in the back foot is frightening, and they should be frightened because a spectre is beginning to haunt Europe again, and that is a spectre of communism. And it's been great to see China guiding that spectre westwards. I think a lot of folk who've joined the Communist Party and the Young Communist League of late have all kind of referenced China when it's came to their influence into joining, to seeing the development and what socialism can offer, and what a future of communism, if China's an example to go by, how it can be prosperous for the whole of humanity. So I guess I'll just kind of wind up there, Keith, to see if you know, you've got any kind of final words for us, and obviously whereabouts can we find the Friends of Socialist China on social media, and how can people get involved?
Right. Okay. Well, first of all, thanks very much. I've really enjoyed the conversation and hope it's been beneficial for you and useful for you and for other people as well. On, I mean, Friends of Socialist China, I think we're quite easy to find. The website is socialistchina.org. So if you put Friends of Socialist China into Google or whatever search engine people use, it should come up. But anyway, it's socialistchina.org. And we carry about maybe 6 to 9 items a week there. It's regularly updated. And there's a very simple tab to sign up, and people can get a weekly email of all the articles and periodic, not too, we don't constantly spam people, but periodic invitations or notices and reminders about meetings that are coming up. So that's a really good way to keep in touch. And similarly, we have an account on X, formerly Twitter. Still don't get used to calling it X, I must admit. And we have Facebook and YouTube, so again, all of which can be very readily found under our name. So there's the website, mailing list, and X, YouTube, and Facebook, which, all of which we try to keep going regularly and update. And we have articles in the Morning Star from time to time. And I think we're always very happy to do podcasts or Zoom talks or whatever like this, to speak at meetings where we can. And we're developing our organizational structure. We have a Britain committee. We're trying to get people more involved in the work. I think we'll have a more, we're just working on getting some of the admin in place to have a more formal membership structure soon, very soon. But for now, I mean, it's like if people get in contact with us and want to work with us, we'll find ways of doing that. Most of the people that we attract are people who are already pretty busy involved in in different areas of progressive political activity. But that's something that we've very much oriented towards and which we welcome, because we actually want to work with people who are active in their political party or their trade union, other solidarity campaigns or community organizations, whatever, and actually take the message out into, work with us, use our material, take the message out into those bodies, get us invited as speakers, bring other people along. So that I guess what we really want to do is, and I think is what is starting to happen to a certain extent, exactly what you were saying just now about people coming forward to join the CP or the YCL and actually citing China, to actually situate China where, being interested in China, being supportive of China, and seeing what contribution China is making to the global struggle, be it against poverty, against climate change, in terms of the development of socialist ideas, and so on, where that relationship of China to the global struggle, and the role of China, is seen as a natural constituent part of the progressive of a progressive outlook and of the progressive movement, where we are.
Yeah, no, perfect. Thanks again, Keith, and obviously thanks for your time. And I definitely think this has been a very useful episode, and hopefully it does serve as a kind of tool to, like we've discussed throughout the episode, kind of combating the anti-China rhetoric and unveiling the truth that's needed today. So yeah, thanks for your time, Keith, and I wish you all the
You're
best.
welcome. Yeah, has it been was it okay for you?
Perfect, absolutely perfect.
I'm never.
Thanks, comrades, for tuning in to another episode of Spectre. As always, be sure to leave us a like and review on whatever listening platform you're tuning in from. Be sure to share us with your friends, comrades, co-workers, and all other networks. As communists and socialists in the West, it's vital that we play an active role in supporting the People's Republic of China in whatever way we can, providing clear solidarity every step of the way. The Communist Party of China and the Chinese people are committed to socialism and the end goal of communism. As the CPC constitution says, quote, "The party's highest ideal and ultimate goal is the realization of communism," end quote. The minimum and maximum program means remaining committed to communism as a goal, but also addressing the immediate demands of the masses in the early stages of socialism. This being a point that many of the ultra-leftists, Trotskyists, and other sectarians choose to ignore, lambasting and sitting in the lap of imperialism, fighting against China on behalf of the capitalist class. China has not abandoned socialism. Far from it, China has creatively applied Marxism to its own conditions. As Deng said in 1984, quote, "Some people ask why we chose socialism. We answer that we had to because capitalism would get China nowhere. If we had taken the capitalist road, we could not have put an end to the chaos in the country or done away with poverty and backwardness. That is why we have repeatedly declared that we shall adhere to Marxism and keep to the socialist road." So where will you stand when it comes to the People's Republic of China? Will you sit in bed with the imperialist war hawks who continue to ravage nations, hoping for them to be destituted to a lifetime of slavery to the West? Or will you stand for the independence and the sovereignty of the Chinese people and the rest of the global South, fighting against imperialism, fighting against poverty, and fighting for a future, a socialist future, a communist future? If the future of communism is what you seek, then take the words of Keith and look to join Friends of Socialist China. Play a part in displacing the myths, the anti-Chinese propaganda, the anti-communist propaganda, which is peddled out by so many in the West, even those in the so-called left-wing circles. The remarkable transformation of the People's Republic of China proves to the people of the capitalist world that an alternative system is possible, where resources are used to uplift people rather than generate profit and fuel wars. So let's fight to ensure this system globally. Let's fight with the People's Republic of China against the aggressors, against the capitalist class, and against capitalism. The socialist development of China continues to haunt the West like a spectre. And all of the powers of the West are forming into an unholy alliance to try and exorcise this spectre. But let us move with this spectre. Let us haunt our own establishments and ensure a future for us, China, and the planet. A future of communism.
I'm calm. I've got the devil in my palm. No, I said that I wear sunglasses at night, but tonight I need to see what I want. Wanna see somebody drop to the ground. No civilians, no doctors around. Who said life is priceless? So far, your life cost me a pound. One phone call and a 10p text. All of my man them link up quick. We don't care what ends he reps. When I said it, should've known it weren't any old rhyme. Got a couple killers that are never online. Might see the shadow in the video of mine. Standing behind the camera with the director, ready to shoot an MC one time. Where has everybody gone? I'm not on that vibe that everybody's on. Same old, lame old, plain old, blatant shame till you find out it ain't working. No. One's for the baseball crew. Crispy McDive. Hey, this ain't private shubs. Man can wear hats or hoods. No Uggs. It's not a lean up team.
It's not a lean up team.
I don't have a boss. Nobody can tell me there's a clean up in R5, cause I'll drive straight to your door. Then I'll spin and power drive your face to the floor.
Yeah, somebody's gotta get murked. Spoke to my mum, but that didn't work. Counted to 10, but that didn't work. Blood, man, I'm putting in work. Switch them plates, man, I'm going on a ride. Black belly on, and I look like a fly. Give mumsy a kiss, tell her you'll be home soon. Come to the gate when I pull up on the drive. I don't care if it's raining or not. If we get chased by feds, everybody in the car better know that I'm failing to stop.